And this is Mountain Money on KPCW. I'm Renee Bodley Miller here with my co-host Roger Goldman. We are really happy about our first guest this morning, author Sarah Smarsh. She wrote the new book, Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Smarsh has a glittery resume with graduate degrees and academic positions, including a stint as a fellow at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. But the book about her upbringing is not some kind of romanticized tale about how pluck and a little luck invariably leads to success in 21st century America. Nor is it some kind of snobbish look about how the problems of the poor, especially the white male poor in what is sometimes labeled flyover country, are simply of their own making, problems that could simply be solved by a bit of hard work and self-control.
Rather, Smarsh paints a detailed picture of a world where hard work is common, but the economic realities of a life lived close to the financial edge preclude any type of long-term stability. The people of Kansas she describes have a vast variety of skills, albeit not necessarily those valued or understood by coastal elites. Yet this is also a story filled with alcohol consumption, teenage pregnancy, and multiple marriages and relationships. It is a world where family units, often headed by a single woman, are forced to manage an existence that may include multiple generations while often on the edge of financial disaster. It is a world where poverty is often strangely mobile, as members of her family move from one short-term job and one temporary residence to another. And it is a world where that lack of permanent residence is but one part of a vicious circle, where children may attend multiple schools in a given year and are thus placed squarely on a path that leads toward a barely adequate education and a potential repetition of the lives of the generation before. We are so lucky to have the opportunity to chat with Professor Smarsh about her book. Good morning, Professor Smarsh.
Good morning, and thanks so much for having me on. What an articulate and eloquent introduction of the book. Thank you.
You chose to write the book as a letter to a daughter that I understand you, in fact, never had, which is a literary device somewhat reminiscent to us of what Ta-Nehisi Coates did in Between the World and Me. Why did you choose that vehicle?
You know, this is a funny question to answer because it is on the one hand a question about craft and how one makes decisions to construct a book, but on the other hand, it's actually getting at just a very organic, true experience that I had and an internal dialogue of mine that was not remotely contrived for the purpose of the book. So this would-be child that I addressed the book to and this kind of entity, as I imagine it, that I'm in conversation with. That was a real aspect of my psyche for my entire coming of age. And it was really toward the end of the writing of the book when I realized that there were pieces of the puzzle that weren't quite gelling. And I saw that there was still a kind of formality in what I hoped would ultimately be a very intimate story, keeping the readers at arm's length, sort of. And I thought, if I let the reader in on this very private dialogue of mine, maybe that will resolve some of the trouble with a book that isn't quite flowing. And when I did that, the book kind of clicked together.
And is my takeaway accurate on this, that was a filter for you? You come from a long line of teenage moms. And it seems to me as you were growing up and making decisions about where your life was headed, you put it within the framework of what would I tell my daughter to do?
That's exactly right. So I think the, a term in common vernacular nowadays, life hack, people talk about here's a life hack to how you carry tomatoes in a Tupperware without them getting bruised or whatever. But my life hack for making very serious decisions and navigating my own life in the context of an economic reality where there just weren't very many sound, good, wise messages going around to guide me from, let's say, caretakers who loved me very much but who didn't really know how to advise me towards some of the goals that I had. I found that if I could kind of circumvent my own bad programming or wiring or messages that might have led me down the wrong path by asking myself, what would I do if I had a child? And that, I think for anyone, maybe just instantly summons our best selves and our highest values and moral compass. And so that was a way that I made decisions for myself.
Well, I'm struck by how you have taken what for many people is a subconscious desire to, I'm not going to be like my mom or I'm not going to be like my dad, and how you turned that into this really productive, analytical, insightful book.
Yeah, you know, one thing that, and thank you, by the way, I hope that the book will speak in some universal ways to people whose experiences and backgrounds might be very different than the class and place that I describe in the book, but certainly something that we all have in common is, you know, we are the product of histories and of generations. And even though my book is, the word memoir is on the cover, it ultimately is a story about a deep history of a family and the way that cycles work. And that is something that, regardless of our place, we all share in common, that we are, yes, in a sense, individuals, but also in some ways at the mercy of families we didn't choose and experiences that we were born into by no credit to us or no fault of our own. And so, yeah, I think that is the way that any reader might connect with this child that I'm describing growing up that I used to be in rural Kansas.
The book talks a lot about how the life of a rural family in Kansas evolved during a certain period of time. I take it that previous generations probably had a somewhat better quality of life, and that there were changes that adversely affected the ability of families like yours to, you know, make a productive life. Can you talk a little bit about what kinds of extrinsic factors were creating that change and how that change impacted your family?
Sure. First, I would say, you know, I wouldn't necessarily go so far as to suggest that there was some sort of downward mobility about our family or that we previously had it better. However, in rote economic terms, you know, my family's always been poor, the poor now. I was poor. That remained sort of a static baseline. However, what did change was within the context of poverty, could we access a doctor? Could we afford health care? Was public education robustly supported and available to us? These systems in particular, institutions, were during my 1980s childhood and 1990s, teenage years, it's, you know, shifting toward a more privatized moment, and this current situation in our country of historic wealth inequality. So really the change was now, you know, we had dangerous jobs in the 80s and before, and suffered physically for them, but even without health insurance, when I was a small child, my dad was able to, you know, get emergency treatment without being utterly bankrupted when he had an on-the-job injury. And I'm not so sure that that would be, well, I'm certain that that would not be the case today. And so it's really more about within the context of poverty can you, what sort of assistance does your society afford you is I think what has shifted.
You talk a little bit about the tendency in this country to shame the poor, especially the white poor. Can you describe a little bit about how that's done and the impact that you saw that it had on your contemporaries?
Sure. So we live in a country that has been calling itself a meritocracy, and we have this tale about pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and an idea that you get what you work for. It turns out that is not the case, and statistically, if you're born poor, you're likely to stay that way no matter how hard you work. But if we're still believing the myth about how things work, then that would suggest that people who have bad economic outcomes must have done something wrong along the way. And if we're a meritocracy, people who are poor must therefore have less merit. And so embedded in that understanding comes a shame for people who understand that they have failed in the context of that system. I would push back, though, on one piece of how you introduced the question, which is I don't think that my book suggests that the white poor are especially shamed, but that is but it is a peculiar experience within poverty, by which I mean to be poor and white, in a country that privileges whiteness is a particular thing, because you simultaneously have racial privilege and economic disadvantage. So those two things can exist simultaneously. And I think maybe what you were getting at about my focus on that is that if we're in a country where that's mostly for centuries been run by people who are both rich and white, then to people who hold that level of power, there is a particular disdain or a specific sort of disdain toward members of their own race who have failed, and for them are more like a physical look in the mirror and to see the shame or the scourge of poverty on a white person. And there, so it is a different kind of hatefulness and venomness, I think, when people say white trash, for example. It is not containing racism, but it is containing contempt for essentially capitalist failure.
You wrote an interesting op-ed in the New York Times about liberal blind spots that we want to get to in a minute, but I want to take off on what you just said, that impoverished people, especially the culture you grew up in, Kansas, it was a horrible insult to be considered lazy, which then kind of influences their political beliefs, because if they were to vote for the party, the Democratic Party, that is more likely to offer them the assistance they need, that would be admitting they have a need, and they maybe don't want to admit that. So they end up maybe voting against their interests?
I think that that is a challenging framework, and there is truth in it, that at least from where I stand, that sometimes people vote in ways that don't make sense for, you know, what it potentially would help them. I avoid, you know, the framework of vote against one's best interest, because I think it, you know, inherent in that is a judgment and about people in whose shoes you've never walked. And so it also kind of implies that somebody must just be plain dumb if they're voting in a way that doesn't benefit themselves. And I don't care for that. But I do think that that there is a real conundrum. You know, I would look at it more as, it's not so much voting against one's best interest, but not perceiving to have an option at the ballot that ultimately is that is in your interest. And so it is perceived as a choice between, you know, which is the lesser evil. What I mean by that is, you know, you were just getting at this conundrum I articulate in the book, which is, if you are, you know, from my culture, there is no, you know, people work hard. In fact, most people on public assistance in this country have jobs. They're just underpaid, and they still can't get by. And so it is to have to, you know, let's say to receive cash assistance, go to in a post-welfare reform United States, go to a bureaucratic office and pee in a cup so that someone can test your urine and decide whether don't have marijuana or alcohol in your system, which a middle-class person might, but you shouldn't, because if you do, then you don't deserve this assistance. It's essentially like, you know, it's the people I know don't want, the reason that they might begrudge what they call a government handout isn't because necessarily they hate the concept of government. It's more like an insult to know, like, I work my butt off every day, and now the country is going to perceive me as someone with my handout just not contributing to society. And nothing could be further from the truth for most poor people in this country. The public programs we associate more with the liberal end of the spectrum, and then on the conservative end of the spectrum, there is an alternate conundrum, which is there's a story being told about individual power and responsibility, and that's not the whole story of how things work in this country. We're big. Systemic forces are much bigger than any person can contend with. So, I think it's less of a failure on the part of an individual voter than it is a failure of a broader system to fail to understand how we can best be of service to our own hard workers.
And near the end of the book, you write beautifully about this concept of political choice not necessarily being driven simply by narrow economic self-interest, but by a sense of self and a sense of pride. One question that I had was, it seems like this book is absolutely chock full of automobile accidents. And I wonder,
yes.
why do you think that is? I mean, is it a product of alcohol consumption, or is it a product of the inadequate maintenance of vehicles? I just couldn't help but note it.
Yeah. Gosh, that's such a. I love when we get down to just talking about the physical, real, third dimensional experience of poverty. And one of those things is, in my experience at least, like you say, all sorts of just moving objects careening into things. And the best I can. So I was even in 3 school bus accidents by the time I finished school, and that it wasn't because the driver was drunk. It was because just the place that I lived, the remote place that was only accessed by washed out dirt roads, was meant that these school buses were bumping down these routes through often very brutal weather elements. And I think one time we hit a deer. The other 2 times it was either snow or mud or something. We slid off of the road and rolled over in the ditch. And as far as unto my own family, I think it's a combination of what you said. One, there's a lot of substances going around, yes, but I think even more so than that, psychological studies have shown that the experience of poverty is, it takes up so much, you know, let's say bandwidth in your brain to just be surviving day to day and juggling all the things that you have to do yourself that in other classes you get to pay somebody else to help you to do, like fixing your car or getting the kids to school or cleaning the house or paying the bills, just the rote stuff of life compounded by not having enough money for a stamp to put on the envelope that will pay the bill or access to internet in your own home to do so, is just like, it is the focus and attention in the present moment that is required for safely operating a vehicle, I think, ultimately, is even compromised by just that level of stress, for lack of a better word.
You know, midway through the book, I found myself trying to keep track of the number of residences and schools that you attended. And I think that's an important element to sort of give the audience a real picture. We've talked about this in sort of broad terms. How many schools did you go to by the time you graduated from high school? And how many residences did you have? And how many families did you live? And how many caretakers did you live with? Just the numbers.
So the first 2, I went to 8 different public schools by the time I was in 9th grade. And by the end of 9th grade, I was situated in the high school I finished. So for me, 9 schools total, and best I can count, 21 changes of residence by the time I graduated and went off on my own. And, you know, through that, your listeners might be thinking like, oh, I thought she grew up on a farm, and that seems like a very rooted experience. That was my grandparents' farm that I ultimately permanently settled on was kind of this rooted place for me, but much of that chaotic experience of schools and residences had to do with my very young parents. And then as far as caregivers, you know, I think that was, most of that moving was done under my parents' roof, or care rather. And then I moved in with my grandmother when I was 11. I moved back in with my mom when I was 14. And then back to in with my grandparents. So, and along the way, a lot of other, you know, great grandparents and aunts and uncles had a hand in taking care of me, as is often in the case in families where parents have to work nearly constantly. But ultimately, my primary caregivers were my parents and my grandparents.
So I'm going to throw Roger a little bit here. I'm going to preface this by saying I want to ask what we thought would be the last question, because I really want to ask about your experiences with journalism and some observations you have about media today. And in case you're just joining us, listeners, we are talking to Sarah Smarsh, the author of Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. And Roger and I both found this book fascinating. So here's what was going to be the last question of the interview. So you talk about the American dream being this one shot in a million for someone who was raised in poverty. Yet, I think it's fair to say you might be that one in a million person who got out of it. To what do you credit that?
Oh my gosh, what a good question. And it honestly gives me chills just to think about it, because in part for the deep gratitude I have for what I think is true about what you said, that my life outcomes do seem to be defy the odds. And, you know, I don't ever want my story to be interpreted as some sort of individual triumph for that very reason, that it is the exception to the rule. And so many people work just as hard as I did, have a bright mind, creative ideas, untapped talent, and those things are ultimately never recognized, and they go on laboring unheard and unseen with their creative and intellectual potentials just sort of lying dormant. And so for that reason, I really see my job then and my responsibility. To what do I credit my outcome? Honestly, I could never answer that question, because why things happen isn't for me to say. I do know that along the way, there were good public school teachers, a federally funded program that encouraged me to apply to graduate school when I was a first-generation college student and literally did not know what grad school was while I was on that campus. Mm-hmm. Things like that along the way, combined with absolutely my tenacious work and the good fortune of having been born with a sound mind and good health, all of these factors together, find me where I am today. And now then, I think that my responsibility is to say, not go out and work hard and your dreams will come true, but rather to say, we as a country and a culture need to face the facts that we have really been telling ourselves at least a partial lie about this American dream we hope might exist. And it's on us now to put our minds together, and particularly those who have the privilege of being heard, as I do now, and the folks who have the power to set the narratives and the policies about this country, to get together and work on that American dream thing. It doesn't have to be so nearly impossible to access, as far as I'm concerned, in such a wealthy, privileged country as this.
In addition to sort of enjoying the stories in the book very much, the writing is truly elegant. One of the things she said that I really enjoyed was, economic inequality is one cultural divide that causes us to see one another as stereotypes, some of which allow the powerful to make harmful decisions in policy and politics. That line, and I think it also resonates in the New York Times piece about liberal blind spots. Can you talk a little bit about those liberal blind spots and how we misperceive each other?
Certainly. You know, I think that, we've been talking in the last few years about our quote-unquote bubbles that we live in, and some of that has to do with the silos of the social media experience, where we tend to congregate with people who agree with us and confirm our existing beliefs, and maybe some of it has to do with a decrease in just social community gathering spaces out in the real world, away from the screens of all these digital devices, but somehow we find ourselves in a moment where we are, on the one hand, a very globalized society, and on the other hand, seemingly impossibly disconnected from people whose experience is different from ours. And, since I kind of straddle two of those worlds, one is the place I come from, it involves rural poverty in the Midwest, and the other is the place where I'm professionally employed, and that is a media center that is based in New York City. I live in Kansas, by the way, but I have these kind of two different communities, and I think of it as a dual class citizenship. And so what that reveals to me is that, the blind spots work in both directions, by the way. People where I'm from don't know nothing about New York, and people in New York the same in the other direction. The reason that it matters so much that the people who have the privilege and power of telling the stories about this country endeavor to get it right and to transcend their own blind spots and to diversify their newsrooms along race and class and gender lines and everything else, is that for all of their best intentions, if they have those blind spots that would allow them to, you know, let's say paint half of the country as a political monolith, you would think from looking at graphics about the United States of America that every person in half of the country voted for Donald Trump and every person in the other half voted for Hillary Clinton. On the ground, these so-called red states and blue states are politically, racially, ethnically, religiously, and every other way diverse and nuanced and complex. And so the reason that I'm sometimes taking my own industry to task is because they hold a lot of power in telling us a story about who we are as a country. And I just knowing my home the way that I do, I can't let it be painted with a broad brush stroke.
Well, I have a request. Will you please write a book about that? About your perceptions on national media. I just find it fascinating.
Thank you so much.
Okay, we have to wrap it up. I'm so sorry because we could go on forever. We've been talking to Sarah Smarsh, author of Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. The book just came out in September, already getting great reviews. And I believe you made it to a list for the National Book Award. Is that right?
That's right, yes. One of the most startling and improbable days of my life was finding that out a couple weeks ago. Yeah, so big honor. And a delight. Writer's dream come true.
Well deserved.
Yes. Congratulations. We've really enjoyed chatting with you.
Thank you. Likewise. This was great. Thanks so much.